Hello.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and a very, very warm welcome to every one of you to Perimeter Institute's public opening today. It's been a long time coming, and we're delighted to have all of you here to attend a wonderful day of lectures and tours, and I hope you get a chance to talk to our scientists as you move through the building today after Professor Weinberg's lecture. It's wonderful to see you all here in such strong, continued, ongoing support for the Institute. This is the first of many activities that we're looking forward to hold in our new facility. It gives me great pleasure this morning to introduce Professor Cliff Burgess from McGill University. Professor Burgess will be visiting, gosh, it's loud in here. Professor Burgess will be visiting McMaster University and Perimeter Institute this year, so we're delighted to have him perfectly timed in our new facility. And Professor Burgess will be introducing our speaker for this morning, our first speaker for this morning, Professor Weinberg. Professor Burgess.
Can you hear me without the microphone? Good. It's my pleasure this morning to be starting the first, moderating this first session of the open house. And this morning we're all in for a real treat. We have a distinguished speaker on a fascinating topic. Professor Steven Weinberg will tell us about the origins of the universe. Professor Weinberg is among the most influential physicists of our times. He's through a long and distinguished career. He's had many accolades, and for brevity, because our schedule is tight, I'm going to stick to the one about which most people know. He was the winner, together with Sheldon Glashow and the late Abdus-Salam, of the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1979. What they won this prize for was the discovery of the what we now call the electroweak theory, the theory of the electroweak interactions. They're called electroweak interactions because this theory unified two of the four forces of nature into one, the electromagnetic force and the weak force. And so now it's called the electroweak force. Because of this, this prize looms large even amongst the realm of Nobel Prizes. It's one of the few, you can count on the fingers of one hand the number of times that a real distinct ideas in physics have been unified in that way. It falls in the same class as the unification of terrestrial gravity with planetary gravity by Newton in the 17th century, or of electricity and magnetism into electromagnetism in the 19th century, or the unification of the ideas of relativity and electromagnetism with electromagnetism and gravity with relativity by Einstein in the early 20th century. Now, that sounds pretty good. But I think that's not so well known to the general public is that Professor Weinberg has had an even greater influence, perhaps, amongst physicists, professional physicists, because separate from this, his ideas in effective field theories have really changed what physicists think they're doing when they compose a fundamental theory of nature like that. And so his impact is really everywhere in which high-energy physicists do physics in modern times. Beyond his research, Professor Weinberg is also one of the great defenders and communicators of science in the public arena. His textbooks are definitive, and as a graduate student, I had an epiphany when I first ran into his textbook on gravity back in the 70s. But his popularizations of science are also very well known. For decades, his popularization of cosmology, the first 3 minutes, has set the standard for science writing for the general public. More recently, his books, Dreams of a Final Theory and Facing Up, describe the bigger picture of science, where science is going, and its relationship to society and the general current of intellectual thought. What's common to all of these books is a remarkable clarity of thought, communicated in a crisp and entertaining way. He's the master of the big picture and the artful choice of a phrase. And I'm sure we'll see that in today's lecture. So I present you Professor Steven Weinberg.
Thanks very much, Cliff. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm afraid, though, nobody knows the origin of the universe. We can trace the history of the universe back to a time when conditions were unimaginably different from what they are now, back billions of years in the past. And as time passes, we are able to look further and further back to the past. So perhaps since it's raining outside anyway, even though I can't tell you the origin of the universe, you'll stay and hear what we can tell you. The oldest things that we can see exposed on the surface of the Earth are here in Canada. Could I have the first slide, please? It's the first slide. It's, well, you know the map anyway. It's the Laurentian Shield, the oldest exposed rocks on the surface of the Earth. From the study of these rocks and other rocks, geologists and geophysicists have worked out that the age of the Earth is 4.6 billion years. We're going to have a problem if I can't show any slides. Okay, there. Good. You recognize this. But the elements in the Earth are older, because the Earth and the whole solar system was formed from a nebula, interstellar material that was produced in an earlier generation of stars. The uranium in the Earth can be dated because we can measure the amounts of two isotopes, U-235 and U-238. And U-235 now is, thank goodness, much rarer than U-238. I say thank goodness because that's the material that bombs are made out of. But originally, it was more abundant. And from the relative abundances now and when they were produced, and knowing the rates at which they decay, we can infer how old the uranium is. And the uranium in the Earth is about 6.6 billion years old. And that's a very firm lower bound on the age of the universe. If someone tells you on the basis of biblical revelation that the universe is 6,000 years old, well, you can tell them for sure they're off by a factor of a million. But there are solar nebula, including the earlier generation of stars, whose explosions produced the uranium, which we now find in the Earth, is relatively young. There are much older parts of the galaxy. The oldest stars in the galaxy are in formations called globular clusters, beautiful clusters of hundreds of thousands or millions of stars. One of them in the constellation Hercules, the cluster M13, shown in the next slide. This is my favorite globular cluster. Could you show it, please? That's it? Well, okay, that's not the slide I had. That's about 13 to 14 billion years old. We get another idea, and we know that by studying the distribution of the colors of the stars in the cluster. As a cluster of stars ages, the stars tend to turn redder because they become the very hot blue stars in the early universe burn out rapidly, and the stars that gradually burn up the hydrogen in their center turn into red giants. So from the color distribution of stars in a cluster, you can tell how old it is. And typically, globular cluster stars are in the neighborhood of 13 to 14 billion years old. We can look outside our own galaxy and get an entirely different picture of the age of the universe. Using the Hubble Space Telescope, could you show the next slide, please? We see galaxies wherever we look. The things with spikes are not galaxies. They're foreground stars, and the spikes aren't real. They're produced by the optics of the instrument, you'll be glad to hear. But the blurs, the blobs, the elliptical blobs, those are galaxies. And wherever you look in the sky, we see these galaxies, each having up to a trillion stars. And the amazing thing is that this whole universe of galaxies is expanding. These galaxies are rushing away from us. How do we know that? Well, we know it from studying the frequencies of the spectral lines in the light we see from the galaxies. Next slide, please. This is the spectrum of the sun, or a portion of it. I think I'm only getting a portion of each slide. It goes off to the blue in the left. If you take the light from the sun, as Fraunhofer did in the early 19th century, and pass it through a prism, which spreads it out into a rainbow of different colors, and then observe that rainbow carefully with a telescope, you see it's crossed with a great variety of dark lines. And each line is produced by a particular chemical element. And if I were a spectroscopist, which I'm not, I could say, oh, yes, I see there's hydrogen and there's oxygen and so on. It would take a long time to go through this slide. Fortunately, I'm not a spectroscopist. But I can tell you that each line is at a characteristic frequency, which tips us off as to what element is producing it. But if we look at a similar spectrograph from a distant star, we see exactly the same pattern of lines. Those dark lines are in exactly the same places, but the whole spectrum shifted toward the red. And that tells us that these galaxies are rushing away from us. The reason the light has shifted to the red is red light means lower frequency. And if the galaxy is rushing away from us, then each successive crest of the light wave has a little bit further to go toward us than the one before, because the galaxy is rushing away. And so we receive the crests of the light waves a little bit more slowly than they were emitted. And that means a redder color. And from the amount of the reddening, we can tell the speed. What we find is the speed increases with distance, which is not a surprising result. Next slide, please. This shows how the speed increases with distance. This is a variety of galaxies. The closest one on the top, the furthest one on the bottom. One way you can tell that the closest one is the one on top is because it looks bigger, and the one on the bottom looks much smaller because we see it much further away. And on the right are the spectrums of the stars, and there are a couple of dark lines on the right-hand side of the spectrum, and as you can see, I hope, the lines, that pair of dark lines which are emitted by the element calcium, are shifted more and more toward the red as you go to more and more distant galaxies. Could I have the next slide, please? So, as I said, this is Hubble's original diagram showing speed of recession versus distance. And as I said, this is not his original picture. His original picture actually didn't support the conclusion he drew, but this is a somewhat later one, which does. As you can see, there is a rough proportionality, which we now know is much better, between the speed of recession and distance. Next slide, please. So this is the pattern we see. If we think of ourselves in the center of the picture, and each arrow representing a galaxy, and the length of the arrow and direction representing the speed, they're all rushing away from us, and the longer arrows are the ones that are furthest away. And that's not surprising, as I started to say before, because if you imagine all this matter originally close together, but with some pieces of matter flying apart more rapidly than others, naturally, after billions of years, the ones that were originally moving faster have gotten further away from us. And in fact, you would expect the distance away from us to be proportional to the speed. Now, this picture is misleading in a way because it gives an impression that we are particularly repulsive. In fact, if you imagine yourself on any one of the galaxies represented by the arrows and think of what the picture would look like as seen from that galaxy, you'd see it would be exactly the same. Is there a pointer here? Well, I'll do without it. A galaxy that's, say, think of two galaxies, one near the very bottom and the other half as far from us as it is. The one that's near the bottom is moving twice as fast away from us as the one that's only half as far. Well, if you sit on the one that's half as far, it sees the really distant one moving as fast away from it as we see it moving away from us. It sees the same pattern we do. This is the pattern of uniform expansion. We don't think that this expansion of galaxies is a cloud that's rushing out into empty space. Please, I'll forestall the usual question I get at the end. How do you do this? Yellow button. Okay, thank you. Point it the other way. Okay, yeah, so this is the more distant one. This is the less distant one. You shouldn't think of there being a void outside of all this that these galaxies are rushing into. As far as we know, as far as we can tell, there's no edge to this. It fills all of space. And please don't ask me at the end of the hour, where is this expanding into? The whole universe, as far as we know, is filled with these galaxies, all rushing apart in a uniform expansion. If you don't like to think of space as infinite, you can think of it as being like the three-dimensional surface of a four-dimensional sphere, if that makes you happy. And there's no edge to it. The whole thing is expanding. The galaxies are stuck on the expanding balloon and move away from each other, just as colored dots on the surface of a balloon would as you expand the balloon. Now, this picture has been with us now for quite a number of decades. And for many decades, the question was, how fast is this expansion slowing down? And we knew it had to be slowing down because, after all, gravity acts, even at great distances, and gravity will act as a brake on the expansion, gradually pulling the galaxies back toward each other. And there was, for many years, a debate, have these galaxies escape velocity, in which case, although they'll continually slow down, they'll never really come to an end, like a stone thrown up from the surface of the Earth at more than 7 miles a second keeps slowing down but never falls back to Earth. Or are they moving more slowly, and will this whole cloud of expanding galaxies eventually recollapse into a state of infinite density? And that's what cosmology was when I was first learning about it. It was a choice between these two alternatives. Things have changed since then, largely due to work in a collaboration with the Hubble Space Telescope and ground-based observatories, observing not whole galaxies, but particular exploding stars in galaxies called supernovas of type 1A. I'll be happy later to explain what a type 1A supernova is. The important thing about these supernovas are that, with certain qualifications, they're all equally bright. And so when you see them at a great distance, you know how far away they are. And we can measure their speed spectroscopically. And so for the first time, we can make a really accurate picture, we can give a really accurate picture of the trend of distance with redshift. Could I have the next slide, please? And this is what astronomers have found. These points each represent individual supernovas of type 1A. And the curve here, the bottom curve, is what you would expect if the universe were slowing down under the influence of gravity. And the middle curves show essentially a free expansion. And in fact, the supernovas cluster on the upper curve, which shows that the expansion of the universe is not slowing down, it's accelerating. The expansion is faster and faster. We know that because the supernovas that we see at very great distances are dimmer than you would expect if the universe was just coasting, if the expansion had a constant speed. And they're dimmer because, since the light was emitted, which shows to us their speed, they've been speeding up. And so they're now further away than they would have been if the expansion wasn't accelerating, and therefore they look dimmer. And from that progressive dimming of distant galaxies, the observers have measured that most of the energy of the universe is not in the form of ordinary matter, but is in a mysterious energy called dark energy, which is inherent in space itself, and which has a negative pressure, which induces this remarkable acceleration. This radically changes our picture of the future of the universe, because since the universe is accelerating, There are galaxies now that we can never reach. Even if we could send a spaceship out at the speed of light, there are things we could never catch, because although they're traveling at a little less than the speed of light, they have a head start. And as we try to catch up with them, they go closer and closer to the speed of light, and we can never catch them. And that sphere of galaxies that beyond which we cannot go is shrinking in size. As the universe expansion accelerates, we can reach less and less of the universe. And if you want to go to any galaxy outside our local group, which is bound together and is not expanding, then you must start within the next 100 billion years. After that, it will be impossible for even light rays from our Earth to reach anything beyond the local group. Perhaps a disturbing picture, but by then other things may have happened. Now, this expansion of the universe, which for many years was all there was to cosmology, the study of the way the galaxies are moving, has been supplemented in recent decades with another relic from the early universe, which has taken over and provided a large part of what we now know of the universe. This is the cosmic microwave radiation background. It is a very faint radiostatic that fills the universe, comes to us from all directions. About a quarter of the noise that you have on a television set when you're not tuned into any particular channel comes from this cosmic microwave radiation background. The intensity of it I can explain by saying it's about as much radio noise as produced by a bath of liquid helium at a temperature of 2.7 degrees above absolute zero, which is not much, but is enough to be detected. Next slide, please. It was first detected by these gentlemen, Penzias and Wilson, using a large radio telescope that was built by Bell Laboratories for other purposes, and they discovered it essentially by accident as a source of noise that, try as they would, they couldn't get out of their antenna. And they eventually, partly because of what theorists told them, realized that this was a signal from the very early universe. It's a very low temperature now, but remember, the universe is expanding. And just as the freon in the coils of your refrigerator cools as it expands, that's how your refrigerator works, as the universe is expanding, this radiation has cooled. And if we go back very far in the past, it was very hot. It dominated the energy of the universe. In particular, it controlled the rate at which various nuclear reactions were going on when the universe was young, and it controlled the amount of different elements that were produced in the early days of the universe. Next slide, please. This is what I mean by saying it's 2.7 degree radiation. This is the distribution of the energy in the radiation as a function of wavelength or frequency. And the solid curve is a theoretical curve drawn for 2.7 degrees, and the blobs are experimental points. Actually, there are much better experiments now that show a much more precise agreement between theory and observation. Next slide, please. This is the makeup of the universe. The universe is about three quarters hydrogen, about one quarter helium, and all the rest, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, so on, that we're made out of is a small contamination. The hydrogen and the helium were produced in the early universe. Actually, you started with hydrogen. The helium was produced when the universe was about 3 minutes old, and everything else was produced in stars, except for a tiny little trace of heavy hydrogen and also a few other isotopes that were produced in the early universe in the first 3 minutes. And from that trace of hydrogen, it was possible to estimate how hot it was at that time, and hence predict the amount of radiation we should see at this time. And that prediction, although it was forgotten, turned out to be reasonably well verified. It was actually 5 degrees above absolute zero, but in order of magnitude, it was verified by the discovery of the microwave radiation. These days, the calculation is done the other way around. We know the temperature of the microwave radiation very accurately as we observe it. In fact, it's now known to be 2.725 degrees, which is the most accurately that anything is known in cosmology. And knowing that, we can predict the amount of the different elements and then use that as an indication of the density of matter at that time. That's one of the most important inputs we have in cosmology. The density of ordinary matter, ordinary atoms, at the time that this nucleosynthesis was occurring is known to be about 4% of the total energy budget of the universe. From what it was then, we can infer it's 4% of the total energy budget of the universe now. One quarter of the energy of the universe now is in the form of some kind of dark matter that fills the clusters of galaxies and the spaces between them and holds the galaxies and the clusters of galaxies together. And the other three quarters is this really mysterious dark energy which is causing the universe to rush apart, the expansion to accelerate. Now, the microwave radiation background originally was found to be the same in all directions. In fact, that's how the astronomers Penzias and Wilson knew that it was not coming from some ham radio operator or from some source of microwaves in an oven, in the microwave oven in a nearby building, because it came from all over the sky equally. But it can't be completely uniform, because after all, the universe isn't completely uniform. There are stars and galaxies, and even at a larger scale, the galaxies are grouped into clusters of thousands of galaxies. And that inhomogeneity of the universe must be mirrored at some level by the inhomogeneity of the microwave background. It was very hard to see. The predicted inhomogeneity of the microwave background, that is the deviation of the temperature from the average of 2.7 degrees, either up or down, was expected to be about 1/100,000th of a degree. Very hard to see. It was first seen in a satellite called the COBE satellite for Cosmic Background Explorer. Can I have the next slide, please? Next slide, please. This is a picture of the COBE satellite. They were just barely able to see, at fairly large angular scales, a motley of the microwave background, a variation in the temperature from one direction to another of the order of 1/100,000th of a degree. And for the last, that was in 1992. For the last decade, this has been a main preoccupation of observational astronomers, is to really find the detailed, fine structure of the microwave background. And observers did heroic things like going to Antarctica and sending up balloons, which in the circumpolar winds circumnavigated Antarctica. They went up to the highest mountains and got above the Earth's the moisture in the Earth's atmosphere and observed the sky. Finally, and gradually improved our knowledge of the distribution of temperature in the microwave sky. Just a couple of years ago, a satellite was sent up called the Microwave Anisotropy Probe, or MAP, to which eventually was added a W at the beginning for David Wilkinson, who died during the work of this satellite. This was a truly heroic observatory. Could I have the next slide, please? This is a picture of the MAP satellite. It has a big shield to protect it from the microwaves emitted by the Earth and Sun. It sits out at a point called L2, a million miles from Earth, on the opposite direction from the Sun, where an object orbiting the Sun will orbit at just such a speed as always to keep the Earth between it and the Sun, so that it has a wonderful shield from sunlight, the Earth, and it's a stable position where you don't have to keep making adjustments to keep it in position. L stands for Lagrange, who found a number of these stable points in the solar system. Could I have the next slide, please? This satellite was sent from Earth, there in the center of the circle. It made a number of loops around the Earth to build up speed by its collision with the gravitational field of the Earth. And then, having built up enough speed making these loops, it went zoop out to L2 and went through a number of gyrations to try to lose its orbital speed and settle down to this position. And the first year's observations from the MAT satellite have now been published, and we're waiting anxiously for the second year's observations, which should come out any day now. But all we've had to go on so far is the first year's observations. And they're captured in a map of the microwave sky, which is shown in the next slide. Next slide, please. This is the sky as seen from MAP. It shows the deviations of the temperature from the average. The yellow is hot spots, and there are dark blue cold spots. And of course, on the average, there are as many hot spots as cold spots, because that's what you mean by an average. I should explain to you what it is you're really seeing here. This light has been traveling for about 13 billion years, most of the age of the universe. It was emitted when the expansion of the universe was only 380,000 years old. It shows the distribution of matter in a sphere around us with a radius of 10 billion light years. The light from that sphere has taken 13 billion light years. It's taken 13 billion years to reach us. So this is a picture of the universe as it was 13 billion years ago. These little mottlings, as I said, are very faint. They're only one part in 100,000. But eventually, they will grow into the galaxies and clusters of galaxies that we now know of. Now, of course, this won't grow into the galaxies and cluster of galaxies around us, because all this is now 13 billion light years away. But these galaxies and clusters of galaxies are there, and they're just like the ones around us. And an observer there, observing the microwave background, could observe in a similar map the primordial fluctuations from the mean that eventually grew into our cluster of galaxies and our own galaxy, the Milky Way. Now, usually in popular talks about all this, by the way, the reason I can say 380,000 years as a definite moment is because that's the moment the universe became transparent. Before this moment, all the electrons in the universe were bound into atoms, mostly hydrogen, some helium atoms, and that matter, Before this moment, none of the electrons were bound into atoms. They were free, and those free electrons very easily scatter light. And so no image could reach us. There was nothing but an undifferentiated blur. With some inhomogeneities in the distribution of matter, but the radiation smoothed out. At the moment of when the universe was 380,000 years old, the temperature cooled below 3,000 degrees above absolute zero. And at that temperature, very rapidly, all the electrons fell into atoms, and the universe suddenly became transparent. And so that's what we're seeing. That moment of conversion from opacity to transparency when the universe was 380,000 years old. Now, usually in popular talks, this is where the speaker leaves you because it's such a nice picture. But I have to tell you that the astrophysicists don't just look at this picture and say, well, gee, there's a hot spot, and wow, there's a cold spot. That's not the way it's done. This is analyzed mathematically, and I'd like somewhat as an experiment to try to give you some idea of how the analysis is done so you can appreciate what kind of theory and what kind goes into analyzing these observations. As I said, since the colors represent deviations from the average, you're just as likely to have a bright spot as a cold spot at any particular point in the sky. The average deviation is zero. That's what you mean by an average, as I said. The average squared deviation is not zero. The average squared deviation is always positive. All squares of numbers are positive. Now, suppose I take not the square deviation, but the product of the deviations from the average at two very close points. If they're very close, it's almost the same as taking the square, because there's hardly any difference. And so the average square deviation is still non-zero. But if I go very far away, if I take a point here and a point here, they're not related to each other in any way. So the average of the product of the deviation here and the product of the deviation here is just the product of the averages, and that's zero. So by plotting the correlation, you can calculate a correlation between the deviation from the average at one spot and another just by taking the products of the deviations at different angles and then taking the average of that. That's a quantity called the correlation function, which should be non-zero if you're looking at two points very close together, and then it may go up or down, but it eventually settles down to zero. That correlation function has been calculated using this picture. Could I have the next slide, please? No, I'm sorry, that's not the right one. Could I have the, they might have gotten out of order. Could I have the one after this? Yeah, this is the right one. These are the experimental points from MAP, and some of them, especially at the high peaks, these are from other observatories, because MAP has a limited angular resolution, and you need ground-based observatories to go this high. What's plotted, forget the bottom, what's plotted on top is angle. So very small angles are up here, very large angles to the right, and what's here is the mean square deviation of the temperature from the average. It's actually the units are in millionths of a degree square, so that's why the numbers are large, because the units are very tiny. And it's non-zero for zero angle, and then it goes up very high to a peak at a certain angle, which is roughly 1 degree, and then comes down, and then there's another little peak and another peak, and then gradually it goes to zero, as I said it has to. This theoretical curve is the solid line, and the data points are these curves. The vertical height gives you the error. And this is always misleading, because what you tend to look at is the ones that have the largest error. But in fact, the most significant points are the ones with the small error, which are the ones that don't stand out so much, because they're just like little points. But in fact, when you look at the ones with small error, they're really in amazing agreement with the theoretical curve. Now, of course, as always, there's a certain amount of fudging that goes on in this, because the theoretical curve depends on input parameters. It depends on certain assumptions. It depends on quite a number of them. It depends on what, because of this light is affected on its voyage to us by the gravitational field of the universe, it's affected by that mysterious dark energy I mentioned. It's also affected by the dark matter that provides the most of the rest of the energy of the universe. It's it's affected by, above all, by the initial fluctuations that produce the picture. This picture is really a picture of sound waves, acoustic waves that were present and that are caught in a still photograph at the moment the universe became transparent. And we know a lot about the propagation of sound waves. The speed depends on the density of ordinary matter, baryonic matter, meaning ordinary atoms, which, as I said, is a small contamination of the universe. It's about 4% of the universe. So that also goes into the pictures. But above all, it depends on what initially triggered the sound waves. And these curves are calculated assuming that the initial perturbations before the sound waves started propagating through the universe's matter, hot matter at the time the universe was 300,000 years old, the initial fluctuations were kind of featureless white noise of a kind that engineers call 1/F noise. 1/F noise is just noise in which there's the same amount of power in each octave. So these are sound waves in which in each octave of the sound spectrum you have the same energy. That very simple assumption, together with the values we take for parameters, gives us this theoretical curve, and it fantastically well fits the observations. Now, from this, by fitting the curve to the data, we can learn what is the amount of dark matter. It turns out to be just what was observed by the supernova observations. What's the amount of dark energy? It turns out to fit just what was found before. About 70% of the universe is today in the form of this dark energy. And above all, what is the age of the universe? From this picture, it is inferred, because that goes into this also, the rate at which the universe expands affects the age of the universe. It also affects this picture. From this picture, one can infer that the age of the universe is now 13.7 plus or minus 0.2 billion years. And that is in very good agreement with what was found from the age of the globular clusters and the age of the uranium that I mentioned at the beginning of my talk, and puts the whole of modern cosmology on a firm scientific basis. And I would say that everything I've talked about up until this point is now what Thomas Kuhn would call normal science. That is, it's science with a well-established set of ideas and principles that we can share with each other so that physicists can argue about fine details, but they have a common framework for the arguments. What Kuhn would call a paradigm. It has been established, the hot Big Bang cosmology with 70% dark energy is now the established consensus. It could be wrong. Nothing in life is ever certain. But it has reached the point where in doing your own work, you're more likely than not to assume it's right in order to get on with things rather than always worrying about the foundations of the subject. To go beyond this into the even earlier universe is very difficult, and we enter the realm of speculation. The biggest clue we have is this 1/F noise, the featureless spectrum of sound that filled the universe that started these acoustic waves that we see now in the microwave background. There is a theory for the generation of this noise called inflation, which has become the most popular speculation about the very early universe that we have. Could I have the next? Well, actually, the slide before this, the one you showed. No. Yes, that's it. This is it. Originally, when I was growing up, this is what people thought. The universe expansion was slowing down, so the distance between any two typical galaxies would gradually increase, but the rate at which they increase would gradually decrease. Then, more recently, because of the observations of supernova of type 1A with the Hubble Space Telescope, it was found that although the universe was slowing down, eventually the dark energy became important, roughly when the universe was about half as big as it is now, and the expansion of the universe started to accelerate. Although I drew this freehand, and I'm afraid I drew it more dramatically than it deserves. It doesn't really go up that fast. I didn't have time to do it carefully. And so we have the picture, the universe expands, the expansion slows down, and now recently has begun to speed up. Well, the idea of inflation is that there was an earlier period in which the expansion of the universe was speeding up, and only later did it begin to slow down. This early period of exponential growth is called the period of inflation. And wonderfully, the calculation of fluctuations due to quantum mechanics, due to the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, during the period of inflation, produce a spectrum of noise, which is just such as the kind that we see in the microwave background, and which eventually turned into the clusters of galaxies and galaxies and stars and us. And so there is now a standard, I would say not yet a consensus, but a standard conjecture that the universe began in a state of inflation, and But when you go back even earlier, we don't know. The speculation becomes wild. People now talk about the possibility that there are many big bangs, that the conditions in our universe are partly conditioned by the necessity that life has to arise, because if it didn't arise, we wouldn't be here to observe it, which sounds silly, except that if there are many big bangs, it may well be that the great majority of them are inhospitable to life, and naturally we are here in the big bang that is hospitable to life, because otherwise we wouldn't be worrying about it. Just as the fact that the Earth is such a comfortable place, even today it's quite comfortable, water is liquid on the surface of the Earth, it looks like a fantastic coincidence that we're in just the right temperature range for water to be liquid, and presumably that has something to do with the origin of life. And that does seem like a miracle until you realize there are billions and billions of planets in the universe, and most of them are quite inhospitable to life. And naturally, the ones on which we find ourselves, the one in which we find ourselves is one of the very few that's hospitable to life. The same may be true of our Big Bang. But that's very controversial, and even as astrophysicists argue about it tremendously. I only have a few more minutes. I'd like to say a few words about why anyone should care about all this, what significance it has. First of all, I wanted to say that all of this work, the Hubble Space Telescope, the MAP satellite, all of this has used satellites produced by Earth nations, but that are unmanned. There are no astronauts in these satellites. They're not needed. Everything can be done robotically. And furthermore, astronauts would get in the way. They bump into things. They radiate heat. You don't want people when you're doing real science, except on the ground. Unfortunately, there is a kind of puerile fascination with people in space that is causing countries, Russia, the United States, to spend vast sums on putting people into space. The President of the United States has a new initiative to go back to the moon and then go on to Mars at the cost of hundreds of billions of dollars, perhaps nearly $1 trillion. Well, this may have some justification in terms of excitement. I mean, after all, we support football and the Olympics, all sorts of things. But don't call it science. Don't confuse it with science. That's the Disney version of science. Real science consists of people on Earth sending unmanned satellites up or doing observations on the surface of the Earth and at their desk painfully working out the implications of this. People can be sent up into space and hit a few golf balls around on the surface of the moon. That's all fine if you like that kind of spectacle, but it has nothing to do with scientific research. What really has an impact on our culture is real science. No one in this room, I think, I may be wrong, but no one in this room will ever stand on the moon. But we all can share the results of scientific research. We all can benefit in our sense of what kind of world we're living in. We have seen, over the centuries, a gradual demystification of the world and a gradual dawning recognition that we are not at the center of things, that the universe is not a cosmic drama in which we are given a starring role. It starts with Tycho Brahe observing that probably the stars are suns like our own and have planets like our own sun, and there may be living things on those other planets, and there may be nothing special about our own solar system. He was burned for his pains. In the 1920s, it was realized that our galaxy, hundreds of billions of stars, is not the whole universe, that there are other island universes of stars, hundreds of billions of stars, that we see in the sky as spiral nebulae, and that there's nothing particularly special about our galaxy. It's just one of a vast number of galaxies. And now, with the latest speculations in cosmology, We even have the idea, which is by no means well established, but is a possibility and does appear in some of the most attractive theories, that our Big Bang is nothing special. It's just another bang in a universe in which Big Bangs go on sporadically all the time due to an instability in the equations of motion of matter, and that there's nothing special about ours, except that by chance it happens to have the right properties, the right vacuum energy and the right constants of motion and so on, so that life can arise and we can wonder about it. So the world once seemed mysterious. It seemed that there was a nymph in every brook and a dryad in every tree, because how else could you explain the way the world worked? Everything seemed utterly beyond our understanding, unless there were personalities out there doing things, making fire, making thunder. And as science has progressed, we've learned not only that we are not at the center of things, but that there is no need to assume any personalities out there working to make things go. We understand the way nature works in an impersonal way. But I think perhaps the greatest impact that this kind of scientific research may have, and I hope will have, on the public, is not for the knowledge it produces, important as that is, but for the model it provides of the way of seeking truth. Our science, not just cosmology, but all of science, offers an example of a way of knowing. It's tentative. We don't ever speak of sure and certain knowledge. Some things become very well established. There's a consensus view now of the Big Bang, but we admit it might be wrong. And when we get to earlier times, to the period of inflation, and even back before then, to the quantum origins of the universe, we admit we're speculating. No one is burned at the stake for opinions about cosmology. And there's some people with very peculiar opinions. Our knowledge is based on observation and reason. It's self-correcting. It's also culture-free. The cosmology that's studied in my country and yours is the same as the cosmology that's studied these days in Japan and India. We don't have we don't have a cosmological truth for you and a cosmological truth for him and a cosmological truth for someone else overseas. We are uncertain about our truths, but we're all working toward a common truth, which is not something that is an outgrowth of our culture, but is the way it is because that's the way the world is. It is universal. And above all, we have an attitude toward authority, which the world could well emulate. We have heroes in science. Of course, in my own field of physics and cosmology, we have heroes like Albert Einstein, Edwin Hubble, who discovered the expansion of the universe, many of these heroes who built the MAP satellite and sent it out and did these marvelous observations, Penzias and Wilson, who discovered the microwave background. We have lots of heroes of larger or smaller stature, but they're not prophets. They're not people whose words we remember and go back to for guidance in our scientific research. No one today reads Einstein's scientific papers, except for historical interest. Any graduate student here at the University of Waterloo or in the perimeter, any postdoc at the Perimeter Institute, understands general relativity better than Einstein did, because our subject is a cumulative one. And much as we honor Einstein, no one would dream of settling a scientific dispute by asking, what did Einstein say about this? The world, I think, in other words, we have our heroes, but we don't have prophets. And I think, looking at the state of the world today, of the people who are willing to kill each other because of religious certainty, because of books that were written thousands of years ago, supposedly by God, the Quran, the Bible, looking at the way the world has benefited from its prophets, I would say the example of science is a good one, that we need more heroes and fewer prophets. Thank you.
We have time for a question period, but as you might imagine, the schedule is strict, and so I would ask the questioners to be disciplined and brief in the questions, and we'll have to cut it short in about 15 minutes.
And if there are no questions, I'll cry.
Please.
Black holes are condensations of matter that have become so condensed that the gravitational field on their surface does not allow even light to escape. And so that once the black hole forms, nothing gets out of it. The existence of black holes used to be very controversial. Actually, Hawking and Penrose were two of the people that made it very plausible that they should exist. And now we have plenty of observational evidence that black holes do exist. There is a moderate-sized black hole at the center of our own galaxy. Moderate-sized meaning its mass is a few million solar masses. There are much larger black holes in other galaxies. There's one in the center of the galaxy M87 in the Virgo cluster of galaxies that produces enormous quantities of energy and a jet that shoots out of the galaxy. Really quite remarkable, probably has a billion solar masses in that black hole. There's no question black holes exist. The thing that Hawking did recently was to catch up with the rest of theoretical physics, and there was an argument about whether information is lost when matter falls into black holes, or whether there is in principle some way, although never in practice, but whether in principle there's some way of getting the information out again. And for many years, people who emphasize quantum mechanics have thought that information is not lost. Hawking thought it was, and he's changed his mind. So that's the big news.
Why is there something instead of nothing?
Well, that's an interesting question. The period of inflation is a period in which, in a sense, there was nothing. That is, there was an energy in empty space, but there were no particles or light. That energy caused the universe to expand, and the nature of the empty space changed in a way it's impossible to explain. But at a certain point, it became possible for that energy to go into ordinary matter. Now, that may not be the answer to the question you're really asking. You really may be asking, why is there anything, including even empty space? And why are there laws of nature? And, that's a good question, and I don't have much of an answer. There's a philosopher, Robert Nozick, who offered a so-called principle of fecundity, which is that anything you can think of exists. And so there is some universe with nothing in it at all, and there's another universe like ours, and there are other universes which are hopelessly inhospitable to life, and so on. I have no way of answering such questions. We can't, even the MAP satellite doesn't tell us the answer to that. There is something and not nothing, and we should be damn glad.
Where's the back there? I think the question was, where in the picture of the universe you have does God fit in? Is that right?
Well, as Laplace said when asked that question by Napoleon, "Sire, I have no need of that hypothesis." So much for God. With regard to thought, Well, you know, we're not the only things who think. Our animals think. My daughter's dog evidently thinks. He thinks he's the most important person in the world. We don't know how far down in the chain of life things think, but clearly thinking is something that is produced through evolution by nervous systems, and I don't think it has anything of importance cosmologically, except perhaps in this question of selecting which Big Bang we live in. The only Big Bang in which we could imagine that we would live in would be the one where evolution could produce thought, because otherwise we wouldn't be thinking about it. And but otherwise, I think, you know, you ask about God. None of the work of science can disprove the existence of God, obviously, because the idea of God is so flexible. What we've seen over the ages is a gradual retreat of what the idea of God is, from a God who sends thunder and lightning to a God who maybe set the world in motion to a God who maybe just established the laws of nature and then let things take their course. But we see no evidence of any kind of God, and I would just assume, it seems to me that's a holdover from the infancy of our species, and the world would be a lot better off if we got over it. Well, I think that, yeah, Weinberg at physics.utexas.edu. Damn if I know. I think at one level it's easy to predict, because there's a very large accelerator coming online in Switzerland, the Large Hadron Collider in 2007. And that's going to answer a lot of the questions that we've been beating our heads about. Cliff Burgess and myself and many others. Is there a symmetry called supersymmetry that dictates that every particle has a partner of different spin? Are there particles associated with the origin of mass in the universe called Higgs particles? These questions will be answered one way or another by the LHC. And depending on what the answers are, we may get a great kick in the pants toward a really new big step toward a fundamental understanding that brings gravity in together with all the rest of physics. Or it may not. We don't know. We may be waiting not for the... It may be that what's really going to get us started moving again toward a real synthesis in physics will be some bright graduate student this morning may have a great idea that's published tomorrow and that will wake us all up before the LHC even begins operation. And who can tell? I just don't know. It probably won't be me. Yeah. No, the acceleration that we now feel was negligible then. And at the time these spots were emitted, there was essentially no acceleration of the expansion. The universe was dominated by ordinary matter, well, including the cold, dark matter that we don't know too much about, that fills the spaces between the galaxies. And it was really following the curve at the top of that last slide, where the curve is bending over, the expansion was slowing down. Those spots are the remnant of sound waves that were propagating through the universe at that time, and were, you know, a sound wave is a wave of alternating compression and expansion, and where you have a moment of compression, you have a higher temperature, and so that's what we see, the moments of high temperature mean compressed matter. But it's no more mysterious than the sound waves from my voice, which is also a wave of alternating compression and expansion in the air. What produced the sound is what I was trying to get at when I talked about inflation. And we think that was due to, in a sense, you're right, that was due to what was going on in the earlier period of acceleration called the period of inflation. But it's not the acceleration we see now.
You back?
Well, you're expressing a philosophical point of view that was very common in the early 20th century called positivism, that in formulating the laws of nature, you always have to think in terms of things that refer to an observer, and you should only talk about things that can be observed. I think we've moved away from that. After all, there certainly were no observers when the universe was a million years old, let alone during the period of inflation. We know about, you know, we view the universe as through a glass darkly. We see things that are left over from early periods, periods of great simplicity. We don't even see electrons in today's universe. We see tracks in a bubble chamber or on a photographic film, and we infer, using theory, the idea that an electron whizzed through. All of our observations are so far removed from what's really going on that I don't see any philosophically different, relevant difference between talking about what happens inside an atom, which we do freely now, even though we can't observe inside an atom, or talking about what happened when the universe was a microsecond old. In both cases, we're using observations, not observations directly, but very indirectly, but still which have enough coherence and power to constrain our theoretical ideas. And I don't see any difference between talking about the early universe and talking about anything else in physics. Well, they're very different things. Dark matter is ordinary particles in the sense that it's, you know, they're bundles of mass and they zip around just like others. They're dark in the sense they don't interact with radiation. We don't know quite what they are. I should have said when I was talking about the Large Hadron Collider, which is begin its work in 2007, that one of the things it may discover are the dark matter particles, not by finding them in the universe, but by actually producing them in collisions in the accelerator laboratory. There's some kind of particle. The best speculation, I suppose, is that they're related to this symmetry called supersymmetry, that they're the partners of the photon, the quantum of light, and certain other neutral particles. And because they're electrically neutral, they don't emit radiation, and that's why they're dark. They're heavy, and we know they're heavy because if they were light, we would already have seen them. But we may get a surprise. It may turn out they're not that, and we just have to wait and see. The generic name is neutralino. That's what we call these that would be produced at the Large Hadron Collider. The dark energy is much more mysterious. That's really a bone in our throat. One can estimate the amount of dark energy in the universe due to the quantum fluctuations in the fields up down to the smallest wavelengths at which we can be confident in our physical understanding. And the amount of energy in empty space that we estimate is about 56 orders of magnitude too large, 10 to the 56 times what we're observing. Now, that's not a paradox, because there are other contributions from even smaller wavelengths and from the equations of motion themselves that might cancel that. But the cancellation has to be good to 56 decimal places. It sort of leaves you wondering. But for many years, people thought, well, the cancellation is that good, the vacuum energy must be zero. And that was the usual assumption, that there is no vacuum energy. Well, now we know, because of the study of the supernova of type 1A and also the microwave background observations, that there is vacuum energy. And it's about 70% of the total energy of the universe. It's not enormous. It's not zero. And it's a tremendous mystery. The only clue that we have as to why it is what it is a paper I wrote back in 1987, which is that if there are indeed many big bangs, then the vacuum energy has to be sufficiently, then in any big bang in which there are observers who can observe things and wonder about the vacuum energy, it has to be small enough not to interfere with the formation of galaxies. Because if it's too large, it rips the galaxies apart. They accelerate away from, the matter accelerates away so fast that the galaxies never form. And I said you would expect the amount of vacuum energy to be somewhere in the neighborhood of the maximum vacuum energy that would allow for the formation of lots of galaxies. Because why should it be any smaller than that? And that's what turned out to be true, that it is about as large. It's actually a little bit less, maybe half as much as it could be without prohibiting the formation of galaxies. So that's a hint, which has led a number of people to think maybe there is something to this idea of many big bangs. But it's only a hint, and we don't really have any definite idea. In other words, the vacuum energy may not be a constant of nature. It may be an environmental parameter, which varies from one big bang to another. And we just happen to be in one where it's of the right value, so that galaxies have a chance to form before they're ripped apart. Well, I don't have, it's not a convention. We have a well-defined theoretical framework, Einstein's general theory of relativity, that says the gravitational field is produced by energy of all kinds, and the amount of the gravitational field depends not only on the energy density, but also on the pressure. And in fact, the thing that determines whether the expansion is accelerating or decelerating is the value of 3 times the pressure plus the energy density. If that's positive, then the expansion is slowing down. If it's negative, the expansion is speeding up. Well, it seems to be negative. It could be wrong. I mean, as you say, this whole framework could be completely off the point, like the ether was. But this framework works so well in so many other contexts. Einstein's general theory of relativity is so well justified by observation that until something else comes along, we take it for granted. But that's the way all science is done. We always know it might be wrong, it might be like the ether, but for the time being, as long as it's working, we take it seriously. I don't see how it could be that wrong, though.
Maybe one last very pressing question in the back.
No, they're not. They're, as you go further and further away, they're expanding faster and faster, closer and closer to the speed of light. No, they're not traveling at the speed of light, although I have to say the idea of distance becomes foggy when you look out at great distances, because you have to think of how you measure the distance, and there are different ways of measuring it which give different values. But with a reasonable definition of distance, the speed does not exceed the speed of light, but it gets increasingly close as you go further and further out. And the point I made earlier was that if you imagine something that's really impossible, a spaceship traveling at the speed of light, trying to catch up with these distant galaxies, it's going faster than they are, but they've got a head start. And as you get closer and closer to them, they're going closer and closer to the speed of light. And it turns out you can never catch them. Achilles can never catch the tortoise, because the tortoise, although it's going slower than Achilles, has a head start and always is approaching the speed of Achilles as it goes. It's a fast tortoise. And so there's a horizon in the universe. And the horizon is now about 10 billion light years big, but it's shrinking if the expansion goes on accelerating. So watch out.
So with that, I should tell you that the next talk starts here in 50 minutes, so if you could cooperate when you leave the room to do it as quickly as you can so we can get the next crowd in. But before you do that, I ask you to please join me in thanking Professor Weinberg.
I don't need a list.
Thank you. Thank you for attending the first public lecture in the New Perimeter Institute. Please exit at the bottom doors. Please exit at the bottom doors near the reflecting pond. Thank you.
Will you still do an audio pass-through?
I don't know.